you know, people, there are hyper buyers in both worlds, but in the WSO space, people will sit and wait on reviews of your product before they'll even pull the trigger on $8.
This is Super Fast Business with James Schramko. James Schramko. Helping you build your business super fast.
I'm James Schramko, and today's guest is another person who I've met face to face, even though he's in another country. He is an expert at sales and copy and marketing and conversions. My guest today is Kevin Rogers from theconversionkings.com. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you, James. Great to be here.
Now, you're all the way over there in Florida from memory.
That's right. Yep. On the East Coast of the US here.
Now, just to, to bring our listeners up to date, we met face to face at John Carlton's seminar in San Diego because you're part of his group of insiders in some way, and I'll probably ask you to explain that in more detail in a second.
Sure.
And, you know, I got to meet John when he came and visited Australia, and I also have met him in San Diego as well. So we sort of came together through the John Carlton connection, and some of the things that we got to discuss when we met were really interesting to me, and I'd love to cover a few of those today. Probably the key points I want to touch on are going to be the transition of Kevin Rogers from your previous occupation, which I think is really hilarious, and you know, to where you are now. And hopefully people can sort of get some of the insights into the mindset, that changes that took place, some of the behaviors that you did to cause the fantastic success you're having now. And we might just poke around a couple of questions about copy, because we're always interested in selling more stuff, being in this marketing business. So just give us a bit of a frame up. Where did you come from, and how did you end up being in the Carlton gang, and what are you doing now?
Well, I'll tell you, it's an interesting story. It's definitely a unique resume. I basically had nothing else I could have done. I was a stand-up comedian for about a decade out on the road, high school dropout in the comedy clubs at 17, house MC in my local comedy club by 18, on the road by 19, and my old 74 souped-up Nova with double pumper carburetors, which is really great, very efficient for gas mileage when you're driving 200 miles for a $40 gig. And it was a great education. I spent 10 years on the road. I knew nothing about marketing then. If I had known just a smidge of what I know today, it would have been a completely different career. But I was really fortunate to travel all around the U.S. and have amazing experiences. What anybody should really do in their 20s, just, you know, be carefree. Worked with some incredible guys, many who are still around today. Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, and I did a show together where long before he really came onto the scene as a superstar. It was a big deal that Michael Jordan came to our show in Chicago. And it's funny now that Chris has gone on to host the Oscars, among other things. So in hindsight, I don't know how big a deal that show was, but at the time it was a huge deal. So stand-up comic, and then decided at one point, fortunately for me, that it wasn't probably going to work out the way I needed it to. I wasn't a big spotlight seeker. I was pretty cool writing and being part of a team. Once I realized that about myself, I kind of was content not to be a star, so to speak. You know, what fuels any successful stand-up, James, is an undying need for acceptance. Right. You really have to have almost a debilitating need for a room of drunken strangers to want to like you.
So it's like an attention seeking habit.
Yeah. It's a, you know, there's an old joke that stand up comedy show is a therapy session for the comedian. And that's very true in a lot of ways. And I like to say that I got cured, because, you know, obviously that was a reality for me when I began. And then somewhere along the way, as I matured and got closer to 30, started contemplating how the rest of my life might play out. I didn't, you know, I was really unhappy working in, you know, a midnight show in Augusta, Georgia for 40, you know, inebriated folks. So got off the road, lived in Chicago at the time. And my wife, I knew who I was supposed to marry. That was a real blessing. Most people spend their lives searching for the right one, right? I had the opposite problem. I met the right girl, the one I knew I'd be with forever when I was 19. And then it was just trying to figure out how we could get together. And finally made that happen. Thanks to her, she moved to Chicago to be with me after I'd kind of gotten off the road. We ended up getting married there, moving back to Florida, starting a family. And then I had no resume. So I was doing, you know, I was a stand-up comic. That was all I had on my resume. I was doing no resume jobs, like being a bellhop at a hotel, bartending, things like that, that in hindsight were really fortunate things to do, because those occupations, along with stand-up comedy, were excellent training to be a copywriter, although I had never heard that term before at that time. And
exposed to all these different human behaviors and foibles?
Yeah, for instance, you know, I've written three or four different posts on John Carlton's blog, basically drawing on those experiences and equating them to marketing and copywriting. And for instance, as a bellhop, I quickly realized that, you know, you didn't make your money hustling bags up to someone's room. You know, that was sort of a loss leader. The real value in that time you spent with the guests was to quickly find out, you know, why they were in town and what they needed from you. What else could you provide this person of value that they would happily trade you good money for?
I love that story. But my favorite, I must admit, is your dealing with the heckler. I love that story. I've repeated that story to a few of my friends. They always laugh. Yeah. I wonder if that prepared you well for the rejection that undoubtedly comes whenever you try and sell something.
Yeah, that's a great point. I suppose it did. Yeah. You know, when you've had your teeth kicked in by 200 drunk sailors in Dothan, Alabama on a Wednesday night, and you kind of go through that, and you know, more importantly than wearing the scars is, you know, the education that comes with, okay, how do I avoid getting my teeth kicked in this time? And sometimes it takes going back to that gig the third or fourth time to figure out, okay, you know, I got to come out of the gate firing here. I need to open with my closing bit and then scramble from there, you know? So you learn things about how to get attention and sort of mitigate your chance for failure. But yeah, you definitely do deal with a lot of rejection, and it I'm sure it did help me put it into perspective.
I think that the lesson that I got from your heckling was that you managed to take control. And I think being in control and confident about the situation could give you such a different outcome than if you just cave in, which is, I guess, what a lot of people do when they put themselves out there. They get the criticism and then they take it on board personally, and then they just quit or stop doing it. And it sounds like you went through that trial and you've pushed through, and then you somehow ended up in a copywriting circle. How did that happen?
Well, again, sort of just strange fate. I ended up working for an old comic friend of mine who had become a businessman, and he had a marketing company, and he hired me for the simple reason that he knew my character. I didn't know anything about his business, but he said, "I'm hiring you because I know I can trust you. I can't trust any of the people I know from within this business. I'll teach you the rest." And 4 months later, he sort of had a mental breakdown and threw me the keys to his company and said, "You're in charge."
Did you cause the breakdown, or was it just independent?
No. I might have inadvertently, helped him a little, but it was a great trial by fire. And so then came a guy named Christopher Tomasulo, who some people might know as his pseudonym is Doc Sulo, just a brilliant marketer. I had the good fortune to have him get hired by this company to come consult, and we became fast friends. And he's the first guy to ever say to me, you would be a great copywriter. And I said, you know, what does that mean? What is that? He showed me a sales letter, and I scoffed at it. I said, this is the ugliest, the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life. No one would respond to this.
That's a very common reaction to most people when they see a sales letter.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it doesn't feel right. It's unlike, I guess, everything else we encounter as, you know, written word is so much more polished, right? You know, it goes through so many editors, and typically a sales page is either written by the marketer or a copywriter, and it's intended to be a little more raw. It's supposed to feel like a real conversation, and it's just very abnormal for us to encounter that the first time. It takes a while to warm up to it.
I think a common reaction is like, who would read all of that? There's no way I'd read all of that.
Or yeah, definitely.
You must get this all the time, you know, long copy, short copy, you know, big headlines, or it sounds cheesy.
Yeah, you know what's funny? I just picked Joe Sugarman's book, the Adweek Copywriter's Handbook. And I tell you, it's amazing how much of everything we repeat today was sort of brought to the consciousness by Joe. I don't think he gets the credit he deserves. Everybody loves to quote Caples and Hopkins, and those guys were great, don't get me wrong. But I tell you, man, Sugarman is, to me, like the father of modern copywriting. He laid it out, the grease slide, the whole idea that the headline's job is to get the subhead read, and the subhead's job is to,
and he was really big on triggers.
Yeah.
I mean, I must say, a good part of the foundation of my copy was from Joe Sugarman's books as well. Mm. I read those ones before I discovered some of the older ones, and before I got a little bit more help from John. But the triggers really are embedded in. And yeah, I also like that, you know, get them in, all the elements, the picture, the caption, the headline, it's just to pull them into the next bit and the next bit and the next bit.
Yeah, and, you know, he's so brilliant at breaking it down simply. I tell you, it's interesting. You come to appreciate things through your own prism as you go through life. As much as you should have in the first place, but sometimes can't until you've had that experience. And rereading this Sugarman book, now that I have taught copy myself for John to, you know, several hundred people, I really am in awe at how simply Joe was able to break down his entire process. It's incredibly easy to understand, and it's only as complicated as it ever needs to be, which isn't at all.
How did you end up in the Warrior Forum? Because I'm pretty sure that's the first time I ever saw your name.
Yeah, actually, well, it came over there from, do you remember Michael Fortin's board?
Yeah, it got closed down, I think, at some point.
Yeah, he got tired of all the infighting and everything. But that, I tell you, that was a great board for a long time. I learned so much from people on that board, really talented marketers who were incredibly generous in their sharing. And so I kind of, the forums are a great way to sort of gauge your own expertise, right? But the important lesson is that you need to find that moment where you're going to stop being a forum rat and really put your skills to the test in the real world.
That's a great point. I really want to highlight that. Some people say to me, gosh, Jane, I didn't even know you were in the Warrior Forum, and I can see you've got over 3,000 posts. And when I was an affiliate marketer selling software in the IM space, daily forum post was a very, very good traffic strategy and backlinks. Mm. Now I use it more for market monitoring and product reviews, that sort of stuff. But it is a super powerful thing. I teach it as a traffic strategy. But yeah, from a psychology point of view, one tip I will give for marketers with the forum is don't be the one asking 1,000 questions if you intend to be an authority in the same niche. Just go in there with the confidence and answer anything you can answer confidently, until you build up your repertoire. But you pretty much became an authority in the copywriting section there, right?
Yeah, I guess I did over time. Yeah, by the time I got to the Warrior Forum, I had a little bit of swagger because I'd had some well-converting letters. People knew I was capable. So by the time I got to the Warrior Forum, it was a little easier for me to come in with some authority. But I definitely earned that slowly and respectfully. You know, another tip I'll add to that, James, is that, you know, do as much reading as you do posting in the beginning. And, you know, if you got to really find that balance of being respectful and authoritative at the same time, and be willing to be wrong, because, you know, it's all about ego in there, and you're going to be challenged very often. And yeah, I took my lickings a few times when I tried to get ahead of myself and, you know, act like an expert, and I quite wasn't yet. But you know what? It's an okay place to do it. You talked before about, you know, sort of taking your rejections and things. That's a great way to figure out, okay, well, how am I going to overcome when somebody calls me out, whether it be a client or something? That's a great lesson to learn on its own.
Now, there's some connection between your forum posting and building up respect and authority and the John Carlton connection. Is that right?
That's true. Yeah. John, you know, much to my surprise, had kind of discovered me through the forums. I was shocked to find out later that John and Stan had me on sort of an internal watch list. And it was because I had defended John in a few posts. Not that he in any way needs to can't defend himself, that's for sure. But he appreciated that. And I didn't come in just with my chest puffed out and say, you know, don't mess with John. I would bring facts. I would go research the letter people were talking about or the campaign, and I would say, well, you know, actually, this is the case. And, you know, and so he appreciated that. He felt somebody had his back out there. So I'll tell you a quick, funny story about how I finally came to be in John's world. And this is a great lesson about mentoring, by the way. Just a crucial thing for anybody who wants to succeed. Yeah, I'm sure they've heard it 100 times, but you absolutely at some point have to get a mentor. It's just really shortcuts the process. And you know what? Even if you can't afford it at the time, it doesn't mean you should go into debt to do it. But don't let that stop you from approaching people. And you know, don't just have your hand out, but say, look, I really admire you. I know I can learn from you. And I think I can bring value to your world. So is there anything I can – here's my skill set. Is there anything I can offer you in exchange just for a little bit of your what's in your brain? And that's essentially what I did with John. And I joined his Insiders Club, and I basically said to him, I think I'm looking for more than this. Are there other options? He asked me where I was in my career and said, you know what? No. He said, the only other option is about $10,000 a month, and I don't recommend that to you just yet. Just hang around and keep soaking up knowledge. And, you know, I just really looked for opportunities. And one day he was going to be traveling and he didn't have time to do a critique. So he said, if anybody wants to step up and show their stuff with a video critique on this letter, do it. So I did it. You know, I did like 3 versions. I made sure it was solid. I posted it. He, of course, watched it, wrote me, said that was stellar. Good for you. Appreciate it. And then so then he was going to be in Chicago doing a hot seat, he and Stan, for, there was a big event. It was Eben Pagan's first Green Room event. You may remember back in about 2008.
Yeah, that was anyway, where a lot of big launches came after people had met each other at that event.
Yeah, that was the whole point of it, right? Was it just a really insider networking thing? So John and Stan tagged, you know, a 1-day hot seat event to it. So I told a small white lie to John. I said, hey, listen, I'm going to be in Chicago at the same time you're doing that hot seat. Is there any chance I could be a fly on the wall, maybe hold the clipboard and help out somehow? And to my shock, he immediately wrote back and said, love to have you. Just let me make sure there's room. It's going to be a small space. he confirmed that I was able to come and had booked my flight and went out there. And my wife says to me, I tell her I'm all excited. I'm going to be John Carlton. She says, what are you going to say when he asks you why you're in Chicago? I go, he doesn't care why I'm in Chicago. He's John Carlton. Why would he? He's not even going to remember that part of it. So I get to the thing. I'm there nice and early. And we're in this small room. John's late. He comes in. He's kind of, he looks a little angry and frustrated, right?
That's his normal demeanor, though. he's like the kindest, sweetest, most caring guy with a gruff face.
I tell you, yeah, when you first meet him, you think, wow, the Grinch is alive, and I don't want to be on the wrong side of this cat. So he kind of comes in, and he's, you know, looks befuddled and angry, and he goes, I guess Kevin never showed up. And Stan's like, he's the guy sitting there in front of the sign that says Kevin. And
he's like, good Stan. I like that.
I know, it's frightening, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he says, John goes, Kevin. Oh, there you are. Hey, man, how's it going? So in front of like now 10 people in
You're
a tiny room.
John as well.
Yeah. He walks over and he shakes my hand. I stand up. I shake his hand. He goes, great. So glad you made it. He goes, so what were you doing in Chicago again? First question out of his mouth, I just thought of my wife and I laughed and I said, I'm not going to lie, John. I totally made that up because I wanted to be here. and he just looked at me kind of like a little creeped out, like I was a stalker or something. I sat back down. And fortunately, I earned his respect, I guess, over that day. And we really hit it off at lunch. And the rest is history. They were just about to launch the Simple Writing System. Again, to my shock, they quickly asked me if I would agree to be a coach. And I did, and it's just been a fantastic relationship. So,
you know, I've noticed that about people who are good at copy. They tend to have fairly confrontational or shocking openings. And I wonder if that's like the walking headline sort of thing.
Mm.
When I bumped into John, someone asked us for a picture. So we stood beside each other, and they took a picture. And he shouted out, Shramko, get your hand off my ass. And I'm like, what? So it's like that immediate shock and controversy just to get attention and to change the scene. So I think that's unique to that industry.
I think you're right. Yeah. Most of the successful copywriters I've met are pretty colorful guys and girls. And, you know, another thing I've noticed about copywriters that do well is that they tend to do well quickly. And I've thought a lot about why that is. And I think it's in line with what you're pointing out, James. It's like, you know, it's not that you can't learn the skills needed to be a successful freelance copywriter. But I tell you, if you got a little swagger coming in and you kind of know how to, you know, tell a joke and you sort of quote unquote get it. In general, it really helps because, you know, although I never recommend for people to try to be funny or sarcastic in their copy, sort of like screenwriters, you know, copywriters have a certain, you know, mindset about them. There's a little bit of cynicism there. It's a bit of a darker breed, perhaps. And, you know, to watch John in those sort of settings, you really get a taste for what it's like at the top. His mind is a complex beast.
I mean, you could almost be describing comedians there too. They seem very dark and complicated. The Seinfeld getting cranky with the talk show hosts that ask him if his show was axed. And that whole movie about comedians had quite a dark tone to it. Do you ever have that sliding door moment and think, well, what would my life have been if I was this successful with my comedy?
Yeah, that's a good question. Mostly not, for the simple fact that it honestly feels like I've lived two lives already.
So it's just tiring.
Yeah, it's like, well, just it's so different. You know, people ask me if I miss it or if I'd ever go back. The only time I ever miss it is when I get to be around other comics, because that's a really great camaraderie. And it's a, Yeah, I mean, they are a dark breed, but there's something, it is almost like a therapy group. When we're all together, it becomes carefree. It's like the famous Algonquin table, you know. It's just the jokes are flying. But at the same time, it's the time that I'm most happy that I got out of the business, because I see guys that I started with in 1988 who are still at it, man, and haven't really gotten ahead of where they were then. I mean, 25, 26 years, and it's a tough game. Show business is a lottery, and it has very little to do with your talent level or even your network. At some point, you got to catch a lucky break. And I just wasn't willing to let my future ride on a lucky break. So I don't regret it. But I tell you, I am fascinated at what would have been possible had I had any understanding of marketing then, or any of the resources available to us now. You know, there was no internet. There was no
yourself.
Yeah,
I noticed. You know, some internet marketers have taken up comedy, and they use their internet marketing to make parody videos or to sort of expand their reach. So I guess just about anybody can self-publish these days and put on a show. Like, I was looking at the guy with the number one subscribed YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm.
He puts on a show twice a week, and he's able to get out and get millions of views on every show. It's quite fascinating. So I guess if Comedy Kevin ever wants to get back out there, it could happen.
It could. It'd be a very different game. Yeah, but I guess I would do it with an eye towards never needing any assistance from the industry, and just say, you know, approach it like a marketer and say, find out what do people like about me? What endears me to a comedy audience, and capitalize on that, right? And just try to monetize it internally. And then, you know, that ironically is when Hollywood comes calling. I mean, you look at sitcoms like, you know, Shit My Dad Says started out as a Twitter feed, you know? It's incredible that became a sitcom, but that's the world we live in now. So it's flipped, basically, you know?
Now, part of what you do as a living now is sitting down and thinking about your perfect audience, and, you know, sort of creating the ideal end result in advance, and then, you know, formulating a plan to get someone there. Now, how are you doing that with your own business? Have you got the perfect transition going from that forum rat to coach to established writer? Now, I believe you're behind some of the biggest ClickBank sales letters in the IM space, and you also do things in the fitness market, mm-hmm. and you do some consulting for some pretty serious profile people. Have you got a plan? Are you moving your business towards the ideal outcome in a step-by-step process?
Yeah, the best I can, you know. I sometimes wish I had a better roadmap, but I tell you what's helped me a lot is having a partner finally, because, you know, probably the toughest part, once I became a successful freelancer and could support myself with it, was the isolation. You know, you have friends you can call, but everybody's busy, and you know, you get so overwhelmed with taking on clients and basically giving up a month of your life towards their project. It's incredibly hard to plan to do anything for yourself. So now that I have a partner, we're in a much better position to plan things and create products. For instance, just for exercise, we've been creating WSOs, which has been a fascinating study. And you know what's great about is doing a WSO is when you've got a little bit of mojo outside of the forum, is that it's very low stress, it's very low pressure. So you can afford to look at the whole thing as sort of a case study. And that doesn't mean we don't respect our products and put all of ourselves into them, but we don't need it to make rent. So it's fascinating how different just the WSO buyers are from the ClickBank buyers, for instance, in IM. Really interesting.
Well, I just want to explain to our new listener A WSO is short for Warrior Special Offer, and that is it's the part of the Warrior Forum where people sell things. Tell me, what's different about it than the average ClickBank buyer?
Well, the fact that it's a very close-knit world, and you know, people, there are hyper buyers in both worlds, but in the WSO space, people will sit and wait on reviews of your product before they'll even pull the trigger on $8. Even if it's, you know, clearly a easy $47 value, they're not buying it unless some people they respect come on and say, this is a great product. So that's probably the biggest difference, that it's incredibly review driven. You know, and if that were the case in ClickBank, I kind of wish it was, honestly, because
I wish it was too. I think a lot of marketers have destroyed our industry for the good guys. They've made it hard for people to collect money. They've made it hard for people to retain their pay-per-click accounts because they've been putting out drivel. And to some extent, the marketplace has permitted it by continuing to buy drivel and for people allowing them to sell it. I was actually going to ask you, this is a great time to ask probably, so we'll move off the WSO in just a sec, but with the ClickBank sales letters that you are asked to write, have you had conflict or areas of discomfort when it comes to the sales letter and in some of the positioning or the claims or proof elements or lack of proof elements, so to speak?
Where do you sit with that? Yeah, that's a great question. And I tell you, it's another gut check in your career. An easy choice for us because we just absolutely – you know what the truth is? And this isn't like any sort of claim to righteousness or anything, but we can't write that stuff. What I call the blind black hat, you know, copy, the stuff that's clearly meant to manipulate rather than persuade. We can't even write it for fun.
Pleased to hear that. Yeah. I've moved my products away from that marketplace, and I never really promote products in that marketplace generally just because of the extremely high refund rates. Mm-hmm. And what I've noticed is a whole generation of poor marketers who have used this crutch, I think you'd call it, this crutch of having to have blind offers and black hat techniques, mm-hmm. has actually caused buyers to buy something and ask for a refund straight away without any reason, they don't even check the sales offer. They just buy and then refund, or they buy through their own links. It's sort of sad to see. I love review driven purchase marketplace. That sounds like the way to go.
Yeah, and again, that's why I've been delightfully surprised by the Warrior Forum, because, you know, the guys that create products specifically for the Warrior Forum know that they can't get away with that kind of stuff and expect to succeed.
And are you selling your own products, or are you writing copy for other people?
No, yeah, we've created our own. I can't imagine anybody could. There's some people who have hit like six figures with WSOs, but for the most part, that's another cool thing about it. People are sort of forced to write their own copy, and you know, you can write good copy for yourself so long as you have a good product. You should be able to follow a simple formula and write a decent sales letter if you truly believe in your product. It's not rocket science. It's when you try to manipulate or make false claims or be, you know, hype it up when there's really nothing there, that you hit a brick wall and start going into the copywriting form and say, can anybody come up with a better headline? You know, when I try to go in there and do random critiques sometimes, and it's amazing what these people try to put in their headlines. It has nothing to do with their actual product. They just like the style of a certain headline, you know.
Well, I guess it's a great learning ground, and you know, the sales will pay them for their value. I've always had a great experience with WSOs. I quite regularly pull $1,000 a day from WSOs. I just sort of stopped doing them because I guess I drifted away from that community a little bit to focus more on building my own community. And I also, you know, it's great if you can make $1,000 a day from a WSO, but you can also make a lot more than that now with the next level up type launch. But I'm sure that it's a great lead loss leader, like the old Porter deal. You get the names and the qualified buyers in that front funnel. Some of them probably turn into copy customers for you.
Well, yeah, I tell you what's interesting is the first WSO Ben and I offered as a team was a $500, you know, hot seat and critique. And talk about an over delivery. We were spending, you know, 3 or 4 hours on these things. And that may sound like a small amount of time to people just starting out, but, you know, we get paid a lot of money to consult. And, you know, $500 an hour is a pretty standard rate. So we were spending 4 or 5 hours sometimes. We were spending an hour just on the phone with the person who bought this. And so what's great about those, it was really a loss leader for us. But what was awesome is that it led to some incredible partnerships. Like, for instance, we partnered with a guy who has an amazing offline product for the quit smoking niche, which is a very big niche. It's fascinating to us. And it's one of these things, James, where this guy has had this product for about 10 years and has never collected a name. Not even his buyers, has not one email.
So not even a buyer's list.
No.
would that be rare or is it the norm?
No, it's pretty rare. That shocked us. I mean, he's a really good guy. And he just, you know what it was? I loved his reasoning. He was like, well, I didn't want to come off sleazy. They just bought my product. I didn't want to all of a sudden offer them more stuff and like, you know, demean that they had bought from me. And that's, you know, of course, a really sweet idea, but there's no reason that you can't offer them tremendous value after the fact. And he just hadn't really thought of it that way. It's sort of a side business for him. So, you know, we're looking at this guy's product and his terrible sales page and his lack of, you know, effort on the back end and just going, gold mine. You know, how would you like to partner? And he was all for it. So we're thrilled with the prospect there.
Do you see this being an ongoing business model where you move from, I mean, when I think of service businesses, and especially when you're the expert, which is probably major problem number one for really elite copywriters, there's always that temptation to get on the tools, and it is hard to leverage beyond selling your time. Do you see the partnership model as something you'll roll in more?
Yes, definitely. 100%. It just makes sense on so many levels. I mean, you know, James, that it takes a lot of time to create a working synergy, whether it's a teacher-student scenario or if it's a partnership, you know, it's about a 50-50 chance that it's going to go well. Even if your initial conversations are enthusiastic, things can quickly turn. So, you know, we really get in bed with people for at least 30 days to create their campaign. They get our full attention for a month. And, you know, it's funny you asked about if there's ever been uncomfortable situations. You know, we've finally learned to identify who is not a good client for us. But unfortunately, that came at the price of figuring it out halfway through a relationship, you know, where we've been hired to deliver. And I love the partnership model because it's all about relationships, really, at the end of the day. You know, if you find someone who you believe in as a service provider or a product creator, and you like their morals and you know that, you know, they're out to do the right thing. You know, fortunately for us, copywriting is very often the missing element. So it's an easy transition once the relationship makes sense.
Fantastic. Well, Kev, we've been through the journey with you. It's really a fascinating story and there's lots of good highlights in there. I guess I'd like to close out with just some tips. You know, when you're scanning somebody's a potential client's page, or when someone contacts you, they say, "Oh, hey, Kev, do you think you can help us?" And you sort of open up the page. I'd love to sort of get a little insight into just the quick back of the postcard tips that you could give our listeners, just things that they could pay attention to or focus on first to get a better result?
Sure. Okay. Well, I think the best tip I can give is do not write your headline first. That is a rookie instinct. And it's no fault of yours if you're, you know, very new to this. It's just that it's natural instinct, because one of the first things everybody learns is that the headline is the most important thing on the page, because it's what determines if the rest of the letter is going to get read. And then what happens is they put so much focus on the headline that they feel like that's their only shot to make the sale. And the worst mistake you can make is trying to close the deal with your headline. So I'd say probably the most common mistake I see is people trying to get everything into the headline, and you end up with this big, bloated, long, clunky, over-promising thing that would be way more effective if it were 7, 5, even 3 words, just to grab attention and get the subhead read. Like Joe Sugarman says, that the only true job of the headline is to get the next line read. You know,
yeah, take I love that. You know, I was doing quite a lot of multivariate testing with my latest product launch because I had enough volume. And the winning test for the homepage was no headline. Based on, I think, the theory of it, I guess, is that it's brought them down to the video, which is the next thing, and they've just started on that, and the conversions actually were higher without a headline. It could also mean that I completely suck at writing headlines. So... if you're interested in giving me a new test, I'm happy to test it.
Sure, anytime. Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, since I had my head in the Sugarman book yet, I'll just like give some of his tips because they're so great. One that I read today that I hadn't fully considered enough until I read it again today was make your page reflect your product and your market. You know, don't assume because you're in direct response that it needs to have a big red, you know, 48-point font headline. It can be elegant. If you're selling any type of high-end product, let's just say you have a sales page introducing people to Oriental rugs. You know, that should not look like a free webinar on how to get better, traffic to your site or something. Not that those pages can't look elegant as well, but, you know, test look and feel of the page as much as you do the copy. Because, you know, if there's a mismatch with the way it feels when they arrive there, that can be one of those hidden things that you don't even know are affecting your sales until you play around with it.
Yeah, I think design is definitely an ongoing changing thing because, you know, tastes and styles change a little bit in different markets. I remember one of the greatest points I got out of his material was when you're selling something complicated, make it seem simple. And if you're selling something simple, you know, make it a little more complicated.
Yeah, that's a great one. Yeah, you read those old ads about, you know, with the calculators, yeah. Right? I'm always fascinated with how much technical language he used in those ads, and that's one of those things I'd love to ask him. How do you look back at that? I've heard even in that book he says how terrible his first ads were. You can't believe he wrote them, but you know they worked, and I wonder if that's one of the things he would change because. He really focused on space age technology and all that stuff, and it seemed to work. I just wonder if he ever tested against some of that more technical speak, you know, because it was still a $39 product. But maybe that's exactly what he was doing, what you're saying, and he did test it, and it is a smart thing to do because you think that way you don't just brush it off because it's a low price thing, right?
Yeah, and I remember he had an example of a mouse trap in there that's hilarious. Some sophisticated super duper mouse trap, and it's sort of a good reminder that you know sometimes just that little bit of cheese on a simple trap is all you need. If you get the right cheese,
right.
You're on track. So now you've got a special X-ray report that listeners can grab.
Yeah, I'd love to offer that. It's actually one of our WSOs that actually our most successful one, and we're really proud of it. We put a lot of thought into it. And basically what it is it's seven tactics you can perform in under 7 minutes or less to really get what we call x-ray vision on any niche. There's a lot of, you know, my partner Ben is really good at keyword research and things like that. So he gives you a lot of really fun little technical things to do that you may not have heard before. And I contributed one I really like called Forum Detective. And I show you how to go into a forum in your niche, exactly what kind of phrases to look for when you're even searching through the thread titles, and then how to, you know, go in and snatch pieces of the conversation that people are having and save them into a text file and then immediately turn them into copy. You know, there's nothing more effective to me, James, than actually using people's own words and phraseology back at them when you're trying to persuade them into understanding that you understand them.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. One of my original products called Dramatic Cash teaches that technique of posting a question in the forum of what would you ask an expert, and then interviewing the expert, and then selling it back to the forum as a WSO with exactly the same language.
That's great.
Answering the exact same questions. It was a good little product. Actually, if the listener's a member of Superfast Results, it is actually in there somewhere. It's years old, but it was a great leverage of that concept. Awesome.
Yeah.
Where really do they go smart. To get this?
So, yeah, go to the Conversion Kings. .com/superfast.
Fantastic.
And we'll have a special page right there and you can get it free.
Thanks, Kevin. It's always awesome to catch up. You truly are
likewise.
A superstar in the copywriting space. You've earned it. You've definitely done the hard yards. You know, it takes dedication to drive around a thirsty car that uses more fuel than you earn on the job. And I've had exactly the same scenario in that regard. So onwards and upwards, keep kicking butt. And thank you. If people have comments or questions, be sure to post it wherever you're listening to this. I'm sure Kev will pop by and answer a couple of questions for us too. Thank you.
I'd be thrilled to. Thanks, James.
Discover how to build your business
super fast.
Check out superfastbusiness.com.